Welcome to the Rhode Island School of Design. This is the newest student-led podcast series at the world's leading art and design institution. This is RISDology.
In the work that I do now, you know, talk about kind of with meeting, you know, interesting people and discovering ideas, we talk about increasing the surface area for serendipity. And I think that is where so much magic happens, because if you're looking directly at a problem, whether it's, you know, a painting you want to make, or it's a, you know, business idea, or it's a, you know, interface, it's so often really hard to kind of just take that totally head on, and you have to subvert it and find kind of paths around it. And the way to do that is seeking diverse perspectives and, you know, opening your mind to, you know, the way others see the world. And I think RISD is a unique place to be able to do that, but you have to have the spaces and the environments to make that happen.
On this episode, I sat down with RISD graphic design alumni, Willem van Lenker. Willem is a designer and entrepreneur who co-founded Oyster and today helps lead company incubation at Thrive Capital. We spoke about his advice to find intersections in your career, as they often lead to the most creative outcomes, his love and passion for hospitality, and his bespoke career path since graduation. Thanks so much for being here, and I'm super excited to share the RISD community with you and vice versa. And so I just would love to jump into it. What was some of your background in prior to coming to RISD? Like, were either of your parents in the design or entrepreneurship fields at all? If you could talk through that, I think that would be a great starting point.
Sure, absolutely. So I graduated from RISD in 2010. So just over a decade ago now, and so started in 2006. I was really lucky to grow up in a super creative environment at home. So my mother spent her career as an art educator and an oil painter. My father actually in the boat industry, so designing powerboats, sailboats, both doing kind of the design, but also getting involved in the engineering side. So, you know, I think because of both of that, the art education piece and then the boat design piece, it was, you know, exposed to this kind of like pragmatic or applied art. And so I spent a lot of time growing up making things, but it was often with a purpose. And so I think actually like RISD was this different thing where it was, you know, hey, you should just go create to create. And actually took me some time to really realize that. And I even realized that afterwards. But more kind of directly, what led me into RISD was in high school, and I think this is like the path for a lot of students that end up at RISD, is I got interested in graphic design from like a passion perspective. I was making posters and logos for friends, posters for concerts and events at school, and just found that there was this tool in the computer that I could wield and make things that looked professional and looked like what I was seeing kind of around you know, the media world. And so that was a really, really empowering feeling. And RISD was actually the only art school I applied to. So I was kind of actually set on kind of pursuing a path in business and in learning about organizations and that sort of thing, and had this moment of awakening kind of when I was deciding where to go to school. And luckily, I'm very happy that, you know, high school Willem did this, but I made the choice to join RISD, and you know, it was the best, one of the best decisions of my life.
So what do you think drove you away from like an industrial design department and then rather towards a graphic design degree?
Yeah, I think there was a level of kind of detail and the ability to take something from the computer and produce it. I think as a tool, I was always interested in digitally produced work and kind of using the computer as a tool. And so obviously that factors in a big way in industrial design, but wasn't as drawn to, you know, wood and metal and those types of materials, even though that's what my father was really into.
Okay, so you're now at RISD, you're in the graphic design department. What were you getting up to when you were here?
Absolutely. So it was an interesting time. I think that the students and the school, I think this is probably quite different now, we're still figuring out how the web and the internet would apply to our work. And there was certainly a dichotomy of how people were applying their time and working. There was, you know, certainly groups of students that, you know, spent all their time in screen printing and letterpress and, book binding and that sort of thing. And then those starting to play with digital design and programming languages like processing and building things for the mobile web and really trying to use that as a canvas as well. So, you know, I think that was still in its infancy. And then you had a faculty that obviously was not, you know, kind of fluent in the internet and tech at all. And so you had this, I think, kind of interesting, you know, break and schism there. And I think it was a lot of that kind of figuring out early, you know, early mobile web and kind of early like internet really taking over so many aspects of daily life and of creativity. I you know, probably fell more on the computer side, but I think that you know, one of the biggest things that I think I was involved in my time at RISD was actually trying to pursue a kind of a multidisciplinary education. And this was before there was a dual degree program with Brown, and I spent a lot of time in academic dean's offices and liberal arts office at RISD as of trying to, you know, kind of finesse a dual degree. And so kind of navigated and designed my own education while I was there. I took, I think, pretty much all of my non-graphic design or non-design classes up at Brown. And so really pursued this kind of interdisciplinary education, which was funky and had some quirks to it. Took some classes that I probably were like, why would you take financial accounting in undergrad, Willem? But was a cool experience that I think made it a really unique education. And I'm not sure if everyone gets kind of exposed to that, but I think that's one of the special pieces of the school is that, you know, ability to kind of go up and down the hill.
Yeah, I would say just hanging around my friends and colleagues over at school, it's rare that someone takes a lot of courses over there. I think just because RISD makes it a little bit difficult with the scheduling of studios to, you know, do both and... but definitely COVID has made that easier now that we can take things online. I also think that one of our past presidents, John Maeda, worked pretty hard to sort of bring in technology to the students. And I think he started a computation called like computer coding or something where students can have like a minor at a other institution is what they would call it, but a concentration at RISD specifically in coding, which I think is great.
Yeah. I think being able to provide structure to that is super, super powerful. John, overlapped. He, I think it was his first year was my sophomore year. And so, actually spent a ton of time together and, he was a wonderful, kind of advisor and informal advisor and mentor, as well as a lot of people on his administrative staff. I think there was obviously a lot of friction in his arrival and his time at RISD for, you know, reasons far beyond my knowledge as a student there. But he definitely brought a very, I think, important and different energy into the school.
Hmm. Would you say there's any other individuals at RISD who served as a role model for you during your time there?
Absolutely. I mean, so as mentioned on the administrative side, you know, because I was kind of rubbing up against the structure of the education and trying to take graduate level theses at Brown while an undergrad at RISD, and, you know, I'd spend a lot of time with and actually did an independent study with one of the provosts, an individual, I don't think it was at the school anymore, named David Bogan, and the associate provost, or the head of provost, Jesse Sheffrin. So there was, this was also a time when RISD was kind of re-examining the academic plan and kind of how the education should be structured, and, you know, not going so far as to rethink things like freshman foundation, but just, you know, what is the right mix of education for the 21st century in this school. And so spent a lot of time with that group and thought that was, you know, really instructive and just kind of thinking about education models and how we train ourselves for these things. On the faculty side, within the graphic design department, and I actually believe he retired just recently, Tom Ockersey was an incredible instructor and mentor, and I think had an open-mindedness to the expansive nature of design as a kind of an application system for and a framework for thinking rather than just the tools of building. And did senior studio with him and a number of other courses, and so always, you know, really valued the time with him. And then as I think of a lot of students in my tenure, Bill Folks, who was just he taught one class, and I think it was winter session, maybe taught something in the fall at one point, but he was taught an MBA style case study course. And, you know, the depth of it didn't go super deep, but I think it opened so many folks' eyes to, hey, this other world of thinking about business problems from a creative lens. And he was instrumental in, instrumental in myself applying to business school, and I think had a real impact on a number of other students. And that's, I think there's this tension, you know, there's a tension with technology and craft at RISD, but there's also a tension of like the market and the marketability of these skills and craft. And so he similarly, you know, in the same way with Mato and a kind of different vector, I think found that those kind of rubbing up against those edges. And I think it's good to have that friction for sure. And so those folks definitely come to mind as very memorable and impactful in my, you know, trajectory in my time at the school.
Mm. You know, I was talking with an architect and the dean of the Yale School of Architecture, Deborah Burke, last week, and she went to RISD back in the 70s. And she was talking about the Metcalf building. And when she was at RISD, most all of the departments were in the Metcalf building. And I was like, wow, that's so interesting, because I feel, you know, you talk about interdisciplinary and connecting with various administrators or teachers that are not in graphic design. And, you know, everything right now is sort of segmented in their own sort of structures, and one person has to walk from here or there to visit a friend in a fellow studio. But it's crazy to imagine a single place where all of this was sort of taking place, right? And I find that really interesting.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, I felt that with Benefit Street. I think it was like senior year. Mm-hmm. All of my friends lived along Benefit Street, or the majority of them. And it was, you know, at that point, you're, you know, a little bit more independent, maybe spending time in your apartment or your own studio space, and being able to just hop on your bike and kind of, you know, RISD is maybe everyone's spread into these different buildings, but it's still a very pretty compact campus as far as colleges go. Yeah, sure. And I think that that's something that's really special about it too. And being able to, you know, my closest friends were in interior architecture and ID illustration. And, you know, even in a school of whatever, 2000, 3000 people, to have that diversity of thought and problems that people are working on is really special. And I think you're right that, like, it's, you know, if there was a more common space where all of that happened, or a single space, that'd be great. Actually, when I was at the school, the Chase Center had opened, and I think there was great hope for it to be that. And unfortunately, it kind of just became another wing of the museum. It's a wonderful wing of the museum, but it is certainly not a student center in a community sense. And so I think especially after COVID and as people return to campus, it'll be really important to find those moments of, you know, interactivity and overlap that are serendipitous, right? At work, mm-hmm. in the work that I do now, you know, talk about kind of with meeting, you know, interesting people and discovering ideas, we talk about increasing the surface area for serendipity. And I think that is where so much magic happens, because if you're looking directly at a problem, whether it's, you know, a painting you want to make, or it's a, you know, business idea, or it's a, you know, interface, it's so often really hard to kind of just take that totally head on, and you have to subvert it and find kind of paths around it. And the way to do that is seeking diverse perspectives and, you know, opening your mind to, you know, the way others see the world. And I think RISD is a unique place to be able to do that, but you have to have the spaces and the environments to make that happen.
Increasing the surface area for serendipity. I absolutely love that. I wrote that down. So now it's flash forward. It's 2010. You're graduating RISD. What is next for you? What were you planning on doing?
So it was at this moment where I think this was another thing that was kind of happening while I was in school, which was this kind of emergence of design thinking as both a buzzword, but also like a model of, you know, business application of design. And I think that the creative world has always tried to find like taglines to be able to get into business. And sometimes they're much more than that. Sometimes, you know, it's just a way to kind of make some of the work that we do palatable into the community. And so I moved out west to San Francisco, and I spent a little bit of time at IDEO, which to me was a great bridge into the working world from RISD, because it was this company that was, you know, 500 plus people at the time, and everyone's a designer of some sort, right? You have, you know, ethnographic researchers, you have architects, you have graphic designers, you have industrial designers, and that environment I think was really, you know, kind of a, it felt familiar, but also kind of entered me into the working world. But being on the West Coast and also just, you know, I think given the type of work I had done while in school, you know, knew that technology was going to be this space that I wanted to step into, mostly not just because I was, you know, fluent with, you know, kind of designing in those environments and really enjoyed the application of that, but also it felt like that's where there was the most kind of net new change and the kind of greatest opportunity, right? If I can, you know, I could go and design brands and logos and kind of continue on a tradition that, you know, others had set 30, 40 years ago, but here was this space where actually was calling out for design. And at times when I joined Google, you know, Google was not thought of as a design company. It was emerging as one, but, and there were a number of great individuals that were leading in that, but it was not yet kind of stepped up to that level. And so I got to work on a lot of things that I think as a young designer, like you wouldn't typically get to, you know, the kind of contributing to the visual system of all of the, you know, the cross Google visual system of design for the products, you know, a kind of a rebuild of the entire Google Maps. So I was on the Google Maps team, Google Maps kind of information architecture and platform and kind of how it integrated with new technologies. The first launch of the, you know, the iOS app. And so was able to contribute and play a part in so many of these projects. And I think that's what really has always drawn me to technology, was that as a designer, your skills can be applied in such a meaningful way, not only to the end product that touches users and is interacted with by, you know, hopefully billions of people around the planet, but also to the business. You know, it's really kind of critical, and the decisions you can make can actually push the business into new areas. And I find that to be really both exciting, but also a fun challenge to work on.
Wow. Yeah. So you're back in the West Coast. You have all this experience from RISD, and you're starting to play with technology and design. And I'm so interested to hear about Oyster. And I was wondering if you can kind of give a brief sort of description to the listeners who may not know what that may be. I know you say it's sort of a Netflix for books. I think that's a great tagline for it as well. So if you could go into that, I'd love to hear more.
Yeah. So I had been at Google for I think around 2 years at that point, and you know, actually was not really actively thinking about leaving, but I was going to be going back to business school, as I mentioned earlier, and had made a friend that was actually going to be attending as well. And he and I started talking about ideas for companies. The company he was at, which was based in New York, had just sold to eBay. And so he was starting to think about what was next. And we were talking about an idea in financial services. And then he said, hey, you know, what about this, you know, the space in eBooks? Having studied graphic design, obviously loved books as kind of a designed object and as a, you know, a kind of a design project, but never, you know, really felt like ebooks were kind of treated in the same way, right? I think Amazon famously built, you know, the original Amazon business as kind of treating books as widgets, and I think really effectively, obviously, but not as a kind of design object or as something that to be thought of as precious in that way. And so from a design perspective, this concept really was compelling, but even more so from a business perspective. This was 2012, and you know, Spotify had just launched, I think the year before in the US. Netflix had just kind of emerged from this whole debacle of spinning off their subscription, digital subscription business called, that was going to be called Quickster, and the stock was like totally, it was like $8 a share. And so the future was very much not written that all media was going to be subscription-based. And we had this vision, this belief that, you know, if it's going to come to movies, TV, and music, it, you know, it should come to books as well. And that was kind of the genesis of it. It was like, can we build a better product from a software perspective that I think puts design and puts kind of books on a pedestal and authors on a pedestal, but also can we deliver this model that customers really love in these other mediums to books? And, you know, classic startup story, the quit Google, move to the East Coast, because it's where my two co-founders were based, and obviously is the heart of the publishing industry, and had no publishing experience. Our second hire after an iOS engineer was the former VP of digital from Random House. So went and brought someone in with a lot of experience there. I don't know how we convinced him to join our company at that point, but but you know, that's kind of part of the dream of entrepreneurship is compelling people to go do crazy things together. And built a, you know, really wonderful product and business, and ultimately, you know, ended up selling the company to Google, but the, you know, ebook wave didn't catch in the same way that it has for music and movies. And I think that there's a number of reasons for that. One is just kind of the competitiveness of, you know, digital media. There's so many things you can do on a device. And I think it's challenging to, you know, put a book up against a TikTok, you know, or a Netflix show or otherwise. And then also the economic model that, you know, publishers got on board and gave us content, but the, you know, the usage rights and the licensing rights just made it a challenging kind of business model. And so that's, you know, it's actually just really instructive experience for, as a designer, as someone that didn't study, you know, kind of went into it, you know, learning about customer acquisition costs and gross margin and, you know, recurring revenue and all of these things for the first time. And luckily I had great partners that were far more expert on those things than I, but the, you know, importance of business model fit for an early business as much as product market fit. And so product market fit obviously is this term of when you create something that your users really love and turn to, but it's also important that the business model fits too, so that you're able to build something that's sustainable and can grow and you know, continue to serve those customers.
Yeah. I think it's a shame. I think my generation, which I guess is coined iGen, I heard that the other day, but I always thought it was Gen Z or Gen X or something like that, whatever it is. But I feel like we're just not reading enough. And I guess that has to do with how busy we are, and we're constantly scheduling Zooms back to back to back. But even before COVID, I felt like reading among my generation was low.
Well, you're probably reading more than ever, right? It's just, what's the medium? Is it, you know, on Twitter? Is it articles? Is it, you know? And so I think it's the long form piece. And, you know, the nice thing about print books is that they offer this kind of salve to technology, right? You know, you don't have notifications, you can't switch to other things. And I think that's why, like, the Kindle hardware devices. And actually, we shipped Oyster at one point onto an e-ink reader. But yeah, I think that's why that's actually stuck around, is this kind of purpose-built technology. But yeah, you know, I think things like podcasts and otherwise have become these other sources of depth in learning and observing that just maybe fit better into some of the, you know, paradigms of modern life. And that's not to say books will always exist and persist, but I think their role in culture is shifting for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was visiting my aunt the other day, and I walk into her bedroom, and she has a Kindle, and I'm like, damn, I haven't seen this since I was like 10 years old.
Yep, they still sell them. Yeah,
no one wants notifications.
Yeah, and you know, they want to read by the pool, and you can look at it. It's, you know, it's for fun.
Yeah, I think it's just been a really interesting pathway that you've made for yourself coming out of RISD and diving into something that maybe RISD did not teach you, and you had to sort of learn through different colleagues and what have you. But maybe sort of outside of this design world that you're living, what could you tell us that maybe most people don't know about you?
It's an interesting question. I think there's probably a lot of things that people don't know about me, but, I'd say one is, you know, if I didn't work in design and venture capital, I think I would probably run some type of hospitality business. And, you know, I think maybe I will at some point in my life. I really love hosting, and I love hospitality in general. It's actually something I've really missed during COVID. But I think it's a really powerful feeling to be able to pull people together in a considered way and, you know, create that environment. I think it's a really, really special feeling. So, you know, looking forward to doing more of that kind of in the year ahead as things continue to open up. But also actually one of our incubated companies, that I've worked really closely with has a hospitality team, which I think is super cool. And they're responsible for user onboarding, product education. And it's this subtle, you know, kind of reframing of customer support or community management. And I love that concept for software, especially as we live more, you know, on the internet and on, you know, these devices. How can they become, you know, hospitable in a way that goes beyond the transactional and speed focused nature of that interaction? So that's definitely something that I really enjoy.
So you talked a little bit about Thrive, but could you mention what your role is there maybe?
Sure. So just over 2 years ago, I joined this investment firm in New York called Thrive Capital. It's a multi-stage investment firm. We do everything from super early, which is where I work on in company incubation and early stage investing, all the way through to growth and some public markets work. And so my role at the firm is to help lead that incubation effort. And what that really boils down to is helping catalyze the creation of new companies. And, you know, build that engine so that we can repeatedly do that. And so that involves kind of everything from research and ideation on new concepts, spending time with founders that we may back to build businesses, and then into actually supporting those companies as they stand up and kind of get their sea legs to build a team, figure out their product and go to market. And so it really applies like a lot of those skills, both, you know, from Oyster and earlier parts of my career, but also this kind of new space of, you know, using creativity to think about how does this, you know, company that builds companies work and what is that, the task of that and the role kind of within that, in this lens of investing where you say, okay, I also want to, you know, return on this investment and make sure that we both build, you know, the best product, but also the best business. And so it's this, you know, kind of great marrying of like left brain and right brain challenges that, you know, it's still very much a prototype as all good things are, but, and kind of exists at that, you know, friction point of a lot of different worlds. But it's been a ton of fun. And so, you know, over the last 2.5 years, I think we started, 8 or 9 new businesses. And there was about 5 that had been started before that, in a whole range of fields: health insurance, financial services, consumer internet, cybersecurity, insurance. And so also just from a learning perspective, I get to dive into these industries in a really new and unique way.
Yeah, I guess a good follow-up question would be, have you noticed any trends sort of while creating these companies, or what you may see as like the future of technology heading?
You know, I don't know if I'm equipped to say where the future of technology is heading. And maybe this isn't like a total novel insight, but I think, you know, we're sitting right now in the midst of this, you know, of an industrial revolution, really, second industrial revolution or third, I'm not sure, but, you know, it's, and I think a lot of this has been accelerated by COVID and the pandemic and lockdowns over the last year. And I think that's been a really confusing and heartbreaking moment on a human and health level. And I think we'll spend decades trying to figure out what's actually happened here, from public health to socially to economically. But I think one thing that it has proven true is that it's opened this Pandora's box on technology's acceleration. And I don't think we can go back. And right now, I think as we come out of the pandemic in the United States, and there's a lot of people talking about the importance of in-person work, and, you know, we'll never go fully remote, and, you know, hey, let's get back in the office, or let's get back in the classroom. And yes, I mean, like, of course that, you know, in-person matters. It's, you know, how work has gotten done for thousands of years. But I think from the future of technology lens, like, this abrupt shift that we all were forced to go through, this experiment of, you know, lockdowns forcing so many old ways of doing things to be completely rethought out of necessity. And frankly, the speed at which, you know, kind of jobs picked back up, you know, if you're in a service job or, you know, in healthcare or, you know, anything kind of information-based was able to pick back up was really remarkable. I think a testament to a lot of the infrastructure of technology that has been built, things like Zoom and Slack and, you know, delivery services and all of these things. And I think most importantly, from a tech lens, that's kind of broken this privilege of geography in a really major way. You know, New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, you know, Chicago, Miami now in, you know, in the US are like always going to be very important critical cities. But no longer do you have to live in those places to get access to that kind of work. And I think that's a really, really huge moment for enablement and frankly, like a leveling of the playing field. Like, you can live in, you know, other parts of the country. And if you're talented and you can kind of build your network online, you can actually have these kind of world-class jobs in all of these different places. And, you know, I think it would have been a joke 2 years ago that Miami was now on the map for early stage, you know, tech investing. And now it very seriously is very, you know, very large, reputable investment funds have moved there. Entrepreneurs and teams have moved there. And something that would have been unthinkable, you know, just a couple of years ago is now very much a reality. And some of that, you know, is narrative and is storytelling, but I think is also really, really important. I think another, you know, big trend, and we see this in the work that we do, is, you know, things like telemedicine have had a huge moment because of the pandemic. You know, so many people who wouldn't have been able to get care over the last year have been able to due to, you know, remote access to technology. And this was a really crucial push in actually from a paying dynamic that there's insurance coverage for telemedicine now, right? Again, you know, just 13, 14 months ago, that wasn't the case. And so we actually incubated a business that's working on enabling this more easily for hospitals. And so, you know, I think there's been this massive acceleration in how we've adjusted to, you know, interacting in these ways. And certainly, you know, we're going to go back to the office. Thrive will be back in the office later this year. But I think that it's really unlocked something very, very special. And, you know, unfortunately, it took a kind of, you know, pandemic and a massive, you know, kind of global disaster to cause that. But I think it's really changed things in a major way, in a very fast way that would have perhaps taken a decade earlier.
And also, I wonder if it also could be categorized by country, like if Americans have this sort of drive in them to, you know, keep going, sort of get back to normal, get back on your feet and go. In maybe some other countries didn't grow up with that sort of culture.
I've heard that anecdotally. You know, I don't think it's certainly don't take this to the bank, but I've certainly heard that anecdotally of you know, Europe having a very different mentality coming out of things, and a, you know, yeah. I think it's probably for the greater good as a, you know, society, and I think kind of takes that into account. Whereas, you know, I think the U.S. is more individualistic, both for the good and the bad. You know, I think that it's a, you know, it's a really interesting dynamic, and you know, we've obviously owe a lot to the, you know, federal government. I think, you know, kind of bailing out small businesses here and individuals in, I think, a really important way. And I don't think that, you know, I think there's certainly more that could have been done there to help those at most risk. But I think also just having that kind of swift response, both in, terms of vaccine production, as well as, you know, things like PPP and helping, you know, there's been a lot of businesses that have obviously closed through last year, but the work that has been done to try to, you know, kind of shore up some of these industries that are really critical. And I think this is, you know, it's also exposed a lot of risk to things like supply chain and kind of, you know, this pandemic is a result of globalism in so many interesting ways, right? You know, it moved very quickly across the globe. And also I think the systems that we, you know, kind of use where, you know, a package can come from mainland China to, you know, your doorstep in Providence in a matter of days was also shown kind of in peril because of those, you know, similar global systems.
Definitely. So coming full circle, what advice would you give to budding RISD entrepreneurs, or not even entrepreneurs, painters or sculptors or whatever of the 17 majors that RISD offers? What would you give them coming out of, you know, coming out of the pandemic, graduating in 2021? What sort of advice would you say is key?
Yeah. Wonderful question. And, you know, I think that, you kind of generally, and then I can kind of get more specific, but generally, you know, I think intersections are really the most interesting areas to explore, both personally, but also just like in work. And so, you know, try to find, you know, opportunities in those intersections, and whether that's technology and business, or, you know, art and, you know, so, you know, social issues or whatever. But that's, you know, when you stand at those places where there aren't, you know, people that have spent a career in at those intersections, you can often find novel and you know, new solutions or new ideas. And as you find those kind of veins, you know, really listening to yourself as a you know, kind of source of truth is so important. I think that's one of the things that RISD teaches really well, is that's quite unique, is that kind of inner voice and kind of listening to yourself and the very personal nature of the work. Is a really big part of it. So, you know, while you're still in school, it's like kind of cultivate that, listen to that, sit with that. I think it's a wonderful environment to be able to do that. And then I think the last piece and kind of the general side is, you know, have no fear. You know, careers are really, really long. And so, like, you know, you can take a winding path to get where you want. And I think that the internet has taught us that, like, you know, don't make mistakes or something, or you'll get, you know, people will, you know, roast you or whatever else. And I think it's actually, you know, you should be open to making mistakes and trying different things, because that's, again, where I think the most, you know, exciting stuff happens. So those are probably the bigger, you know, the bigger pieces. And then I think, you know, more specifically maybe is that, you know, the future, and this goes back to your question on technology, but, you know, more of, I think the skilled jobs in the future are either going to be leaning on the ability to direct technology or tell stories that capture human attention and kind of storytelling and building narrative. And I think RISD is really well positioned for the latter. And so it's almost like thinking of your skill set and the toolkit you leave the school with less as, I know how to paint really well, or I know how to compose this photograph, or, you know, build this bench, but rather how do those skills kind of translate into the ability to capture human emotion and translate it. And I think some of my classmates that have, you know, been most successful in that way of personal expression have really, you know, seen whether it's, you know, their iPhone camera, or it's, you know, Photoshop, or it's, you know, some interactive art as tools and not the, you know, be all end all of their skill. And just like any tool, like, you're going to have to pick up, we're all going to have to learn new tools as our careers advance. You know, when I graduated, there was, you know, Oculus didn't exist as a company, right? And, you know, VR still feels a ways away, but is that, you know, how does that medium kind of translate into the future? Things like, you know, augmented reality and others. And so these mediums will continue to change. And so just kind of being fluid there, but applying your, you know, skills and tool set into them is I think a really important, you know, skill to keep in mind and to remain young in that way.
Absolutely. Yeah. One of my specific professors, he says, don't even bother learning all these different software programs that a lot of architects use because they'll just be out of date in, in 3 or 4 years. And just what's the narrative that you're trying to get come across? So I completely agree with you on that point.
And more of that will become automated too, right? And I think if you become a tool master, I think you also run the risk that the tool becomes outdated or it becomes automated in some way. And I think that, you know, that obviously applies more to some of the design disciplines than maybe some of the fine art disciplines. But that I think is a really relevant reminder.
Mm. And so last question I love to ask everybody is, and you may have sort of touched on it at various points, but what would you say makes RISD RISD?
I think it's, you know, it's the intensity of the place, you know, it's the intensity of a studio culture. It's, as I said before, you know, it's the, like the personal nature of the work, is really unique. And you know, I think also we haven't talked about this, but I think Providence is actually a big part of it too. You know, there's great art schools around on the West Coast and New York and elsewhere. But it's not a particularly distracting place. It's a lovely city. Yeah. And I, you know, grew up in Rhode Island, but, I think very much that academy environment where, you know, as you said, like all these people are on campus, they're all here for this reason. They made this intentional decision. They worked really hard to get here. And that's a place where you can kind of learn and listen to your own voice and not, you know, be distracted by the, you know, kind of shiniest, newest thing that, you know, is important. And I think you can still get some exposure to, but keeps you in this really special learning environment.
Yeah. Some of my friends definitely joke around about how boring Providence can be, but maybe it's
especially
for
like
the better.
February, definitely. There's, yeah, it's not the, it's not the most lively place.
Yeah, those winter session abroad classes sound very appealing during that time.
Definitely, definitely.
The views, information, or opinions expressed during the RISDology podcast series are solely those of the individuals involved and may not express the views of the Rhode Island School of Design. RISD is not responsible and does not verify the accuracy of the information contained in our podcast series. The primary purpose of RISDology is to educate, entertain, and enlighten. If you have any recommendations for guests, please reach out to us on our Instagram page. RISDology is currently looking for students who are interested in joining the team. If you have a passion for post-production or sound editing, please let us know.